listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world, and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and skilled authors who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, while my co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek, takes time away from the show, we're bringing in some wonderful guest hosts who, like Matt, are making a positive difference in the lives of others. Today, my co-host is Dr. John DeWitt. Now, John played professional football for 12 years in the CFL in Montreal, the XFL in San Francisco, in Europe where he won the World Bowl in 1996, and the NFL for the Houston Oilers. After football, John attended Southern California University of Health Sciences and got his Doctor of Chiropractic degree. He then became an advanced sports nutrition specialist and is certified in concussion assessment. Now, his father currently suffers with early onset dementia that has driven John to study more in depth about brain health, concussions, and natural ways to protect the brain. Now, personally, John has shared with me that he suffered at least 4 concussions during his own football career. His mission is to share what he has learned both from personal and perspective, by a personal and professional perspective. Now, John, first, thank you for being here on Answers for the Family.
Thank you so much, Alan. I really appreciate it. I'm really excited to be here and hope that I can contribute. I know I can, and unfortunately, hopefully, it won't be with brain injury stuff for this particular episode. But, you know, I'm here to contribute however I can.
Well, we certainly appreciate it. And now, we don't have our guest on the line yet, so in the meantime, tell us a little bit about your new book, Head Games, Concussions and CTE, and where do we go from here?
Concussions are something that have really been in the news. We're in the news a lot before the whole national anthem thing happened with the NFL. That kind of has taken over now. But ever since 2015, when they came out with the movie Concussion, I was concerned for my own health, and I'd seen a lot of teammates that had had problems, and I just, as you mentioned, my dad's been suffering, and I really have originally thought that concussions were just, oh, you bruised your brain, you got some problems, you know, take a nap or whatever, and you'll be fine. Well, I went in much more in depth and found out there's a whole neurometabolic pathway and cascade of events that happens after a concussion that decreases the circulation to the brain for up to a week. It causes all kinds of different influx into the mitochondria at a microscopic level. There's all kinds of things that are going on. And so I decided to put all that information into a book that is going to show how much more complicated a concussion actually is, but also some simple things that you can do as far as brain-boosting exercises and different nutritional aspects of how you can kind of protect yourself from concussions, because it's not just football. It's soccer, it's lacrosse, it's all these different sports, and it's important that parents be aware of the risks that their kids might be taking. And I don't want everybody to panic and say, oh my gosh, I'm not going to let little Junior play football, because there's still a lot of great life lessons you can learn from team sports. They just need to make sure they're doing everything they can as far as the equipment and the nutritional aspects, as I said, everything they can to make sure that they're as safe and protected as they can be.
Now, and you mentioned in regards to, we don't want parents to go ahead and pull their kids from all sports, but what are some of the differences between doing these sports at a young age and how that affects the brain versus once you become an adult and you're playing at a much higher level?
It's one of those things where Dr. Malu, that was the doctor in Concussion, the movie, he talks about how until you're 18, those neural connections in your brain aren't fully formed yet, so you're a little more susceptible to injury. And that's why it's important and a little tricky, because if you want your son or daughter, if it's another type of sport where they have scholarships, like my niece, for instance, is playing volleyball at Azusa Pacific right now, and you have to make sure if they want to get a scholarship, they have to play before they're 18 because mm-hmm. that's already college age. And so it's kind of a conflict and kind of tricky because you have to make sure they're getting the experience. You want to make sure they are athletic and talented enough to play in those particular sports and maybe get a scholarship like I was lucky enough to do at Vanderbilt. But it is one of those things where you have to protect them when they're younger because, you know, as you know, as a parent, you don't want to feel like you're putting your children at an unnecessary risk. And that's why technique is really important. Always keeping your head up for the football to make sure you're not like bending your head down. Things like that. So, but anyway, we can talk about this more later because it sounds like we have somebody else on the line.
Well, that's right. Our guest is on and actually Mike, go ahead and hang for just a minute. And so John, if somebody is out there and if they need a single point of contact for relevant resources and support for all aspects of concussions, or persistent systems, where would you send them?
They would go to beyondconcussion.org. That's a really great center down in San Diego that really has, they're working with Junior Seau's sister and a lot of other people that have been suffering, and their own children themselves have been suffering. So that's the place to go, beyondconcussion.org.
Okay, great. And so if for more information on this really important subject, I want everybody to know that John will be our guest on December 11th. So tell your friends and your family to please join us as we will go much deeper into a lot of new information about concussions and what you can do to minimize the risk to you and your loved ones. Now, it is that time of year. The requests start pouring in. Can you get me a Nintendo Switch? The new Call of Duty Ops just came out. You know, can I have it for Christmas? You know, and everyone else is getting an Xbox. Why can't we get one? And at the same time, many parents are watching the news with its daily stories of terrorist attacks and mass shootings and wonder, is there a connection between these video games and violence? And even if there isn't, how will I get my son or daughter to come to dinner on time without turning the house into a live version of Battlefield 4? So our topic today is a mindfulness approach to video games for play-based social emotional learning. And we're going to talk about how, when, and even if you should set limits on video games with youth. And how do we screen them and decide what our family limits are rather than just rely on experts or ratings? Our guest will share his experience as a gamer-affirmative psychotherapist and his take on how to approach both healthy and problematic video game use. So our guest is an early adopter. He's an enterprise social media platform co-founder and psychotherapist, Mike Langlois. And obviously he wears many hats, from clinical social worker to corporate consultant for Fortune 500 companies and nonprofits. He's committed to applying principles of play and game design to psychology and education to maximize fun and learning. Now, a gamer affirmative psychotherapist and educator, Mike is interested in team building between the video game industry, consumers, and mental health. He is the author of Reset, Video Games and Psychotherapy, and has conducted workshops on the subject at Harvard University, Boston College, and dozens of other organizations. Now, Mike received his bachelor's degree from Connecticut College in 1991 and his master's of social work from Smith College in 1994. He is a licensed independent clinical social worker with 20 years' experience counseling adults, children, adolescents, and families. Mike, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're really good to have you. I'm glad that we were able to connect. And I think one of the things is that share with us a little bit about what a gamer affirmative therapist is.
Sure. And I want to apologize for the technical difficulties. And I should have warned you that ever since I started doing technical stuff in terms of lecturing and talking with people on technology and integrating it with psychology. Every single time I do a presentation, some sort of technology thing happens. It's sort of this weird curse. But what a gamer affirmative therapist is, it's a term I coined because when I first started doing treatment, probably around 25 years ago, we had begun using the term gay affirmative therapist. And it was because at that time, being LGBT was still so pathologized and so criticized that therapists actually had to advertise themselves as gay affirmative therapists to signal, hey, I'm not going to assume you have a mental illness because you happen to be different. And when I started doing work with gaming, I started noticing a similar pathology that people started to assume the minute someone said they were a gamer, that they had a problem, that they were addicted or they were prone to violence, or they had even, I had people even saying that somebody was definitely on the autism spectrum because they spent a lot of time on the computer. So I decided I needed to take kind of a page from the gay affirmative therapist book and start to create an identity as a gamer affirmative therapist so that people could know that I wasn't going to necessarily pathologize them if they showed up wanting to talk about video games.
Okay. So with that in mind, you know, everybody knows a lot about the gaming industry now because it's all over the place. It seems to be the industry that's spending more on commercials on television than probably anything else other than maybe beer. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, using games in more of a play therapy situation or how it can be used in a much more positive situation with our young people.
Sure. You know, I first started using games as a way of connecting with people. And it started before I was doing the therapy part. It started when I was playing video games. And I remember I was actually working more with adults at this point. And I was at the same time playing this game that was an online game called Ultima Online. And because I was a therapist, I would always be asking questions when I was playing in the chat. And one night I was playing and I was discovering that the people I was playing with were actually veterans. They were actually stationed at the time in country, so they were active duty. And they were stationed in Iraq. And this was something they were doing for relaxation and to kind of keep themselves occupied while they were actually being shelled. And I thought that was really fascinating that we were playing games where you would be running around and dying and coming back to life and trying to do the same thing over and over again. And that it started to make me think that, you know, who are the people behind these games? Who are the people playing these games? And so for as long as I've been playing, I've always started asking questions about who people were. And what I discovered was they were really people just like everybody else that were looking for some form of relationship and connection. And when I started to work more primarily with kids, I started doing work in an inner city public school system. And I was working specifically with kids that were getting what we called at the time special education services. These were kids that often had learning disabilities. Sometimes they had emotional disabilities. And they were in smaller classrooms or trying to be included into larger settings. And the teachers and I would just do whatever we could to get them to learn. So we didn't necessarily spend a lot of time, you know, theorizing about whether video games were good for kids or not. They had the kids' attention already. So we started to integrate using video games and technology right from the beginning. So I would, you know, kids would come into school and I would be playing Nintendo GameCube with them, or I would be talking with them about what they were playing. And, you know, at first, of course, the teachers and the parents thought I was, you know, crazy. But what we started to notice was once kids were able to realize that you were interested in understanding them and connecting with what they were interested in, they actually started to open up. And once they started to open up, you could start to do the work of therapy And the funny thing about therapy is when you start to feel calmer and when you start to feel more attended to, you can learn better. So you know, we started to notice that those things were causing a lot of success, and we just kept going with it. And, you know, years later, I'm now working in more in a private practice setting, and it's great. I'm my own boss. I don't have to tell anybody, ask for reasons for doing things. But I have an Xbox in my room. There's a little TV in the office, and everybody just knows that's part of the therapy practice for working with me.
Nice. Hi, Mike. This is Dr. DeWitt here. I was curious because as you're talking about that, you're showing how when the kids have a potential problem, but then you can relate to them with that similarity with the game, then that kind of, because I've played a bunch of similar games to this, as Minecraft and things like that. It's just that common interest that really helps make you seem more like a friend and a counselor instead of some scary doctor that's trying to like tell them there's something wrong with them. And I think that's really, really impressive.
Well, that's right. That's a good thing to notice. And you know, when you get into the, then once you actually get into the games like Minecraft, then there are these amazing lessons. So, you know, for those of you in the in your audience that have played Minecraft, especially the kids, you dig a hole in Minecraft and it stays a hole. You chop down a tree, it stays a tree. And the message stays chopped down. And the message to kids are, you have an impact in the world. You matter. What you do matters. And that's a really powerful lesson for kids, especially kids who may be feeling really unsuccessful and really powerless in school. So, you know, the fact that you can blow things up with TNT may be concerning to parents, but it's really kids learning that what they do has a consequence. What they do matters and can change the environment. And that's really a goal we want kids to learn.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And what you're saying is that a game like Minecraft actually emulates a level of human consciousness.
Right. Yes. No, it's one of the things that is really wonderful about Minecraft is I can usually use it to help a kid that does work and live with autism to understand what perspective taking is. That for folks that are familiar with autism, there's this part of it called theory of mind, which is a really fancy way of saying the ability to grasp that other people outside of you also have a mind like you do, and that can be something that can be hard for people to do. And so one of the things that's awesome about Minecraft is you can, with one key, switch from a first person perspective to a third person or over the shoulder perspective. And you can sort of help the kids see how things seem much more immediate, much more urgent when you're in a first person's perspective. But then you hit the key and you see the person walking around doing things. And then when you're in a multiplayer environment and you see all those other over the shoulder third person people, you can say, this is the connection. This is the connection. Those other people all have their own first person experience too. And go ahead.
No, I think we lost you for a moment there. I really like what you're saying in regards to dealing with autism. Is there something that works better for them? In other words, if they're doing it themselves, do they see themselves more from a first person or more from a third person?
Well, I think being able to switch back and forth and be able to see that there are all these other characters running around in when they're playing multiplayer, whether it be PvP, person versus person, or sort of vanilla servers, which is, you know, people doing cooperative play. You get to see these other characters and you can know that they're characters like you. And that is a huge piece. The other thing that I think is a really important piece is that text-based chat can actually be a lot more comfortable for some people with autism or people that just like to express themselves differently, that some people do better with text-based stuff where there's not emotional cues to have to pay attention to, or where everybody is having to put in things like emojis and emoticons so that you get those cues. So I think that there's a lot of ways that we tend to think that chatting in a text-based way, you lose stuff. But I actually think for some folks, especially folks that have autism, you may actually gain things.
And I can see, too, how, Dr. DeWitt again, how the social interaction and the similarity, like I was saying before, how it helps you as a therapist for them to kind of see you on the you're similar. And then when they're actually in the game and they're able to chat with other players, that it actually is like their own little world. Like you said, it's like a safe zone for them to talk about similar things. And so they feel like part of a bigger group.
You're right. And you know what's interesting is there have been kids that will come to my office and they will be sitting there and they will be mad at me. They don't want to be in therapy. Their parents have made them come. They think I'm stupid. They think this is stupid. But I actually, one day, they're sick. And the parent doesn't want to bring them in and doesn't want to cancel. And I say, okay, well, why don't we go online and play Minecraft? And I actually have a better session with them doing that. They're more engaged. They're actually willing to talk with me. And they're able to take a leadership role in the therapy by explaining to me, okay, this is the world we're in. This is the server we're on. Yeah. These are the things you can do. This is where you go.
Yeah, it's totally empowering
for
them.
Go ahead.
It's totally empowering for them to kind of be the one that's teaching you.
Yeah, and it's also easier for them to put aside, okay, I'm in therapy, because they're not sitting in a room with a therapist. They're actually playing a game. Yeah. And, you don't have to be on a couch to be doing the work we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
No, you're absolutely right. And so what I hear you saying is that the video games are actually functioning as part of their social media. Is this something that they then take and use it and expand out to communicate with others?
That has been my experience. And, one of the things I keep harping on when I do talk with people about this is to remember video games are social media. What a lot of your listeners are probably remembering, if they are my age or even a little younger, are things like Pong or Space Invaders, where it was one or at most two people staring at a TV screen. But that's not what video games are anymore. The video games now are actually very networked, very social. These kids and adolescents are talking with each other. Some of them I know are even doing their homework while they're playing Call of Duty or any number of games. There is a lot more social interaction. And which is why, one time I did a conversation I was really lucky. I got to go do a workshop at a school, and it was the Horace Mann School in New York. And I got to do a parent meeting, but before I did a parent meeting, I got to do student assemblies with all the middle school kids. And I said, I'm going to be talking to your parents tonight. What's the one thing they should know about video games? And one young man raised his hand and said, can you please tell my mom that in multiplayer, there is no pause? And I thought, that's great. Because parents are coming from the perspective of, well, they should just come down for dinner. They're not doing anything. Whereas actually, kids are often teaming up with 20 other kids. So you've put your kid in a bind. You've raised them to believe in family values like teamwork is important. We're loyal to each other. Don't give up on things. Cooperate with others. And now you're basically saying, pull the plug and leave all these people in a dungeon with a dragon to die. And that's what causes some of these fights.
Mm-hmm.
It's because the parents often don't realize that kids are actually doing teaming and being loyal and doing problem solving. They're just doing it inside in front of a television, not somewhere else.
And do you encourage the parents to also play Minecraft and similar things just so they can talk to their kids on similar subjects?
I absolutely do. I talk with parents about what I call the over-the-shoulder attitude, which is when you look over the shoulder, what you see is a kid staring glassy-eyed at the screen, and you are convinced that, like, oh my God, I'm turning this kid into a zombie. Their brain is just deteriorating. And the trick is to actually play the game, and then you lose the over-the-shoulder perspective, and you suddenly realize, oh, this is a world. I'm immersed in something. I'm actually doing problem solving. I'm doing something exciting and engaging. And I do ask parents to do that. I often tell parents, please do not park your kids on ratings or privacy settings. Always do things yourself. That you know, we have ratings as guidelines, but a lot of times parents want to just say, oh, it's rated M, you can't watch it, or it's not rated M, so it's okay. And I think that's a bad move. I think that each family has slightly different values and slightly different ways of looking at the world. And some folks may be okay with certain games and some folks won't. And what I encourage parents to do is always, you know, explore the game. If it's a question of buying it, check it out yourself. And then think about it, and then play it with your kid and talk about it if you think you're ready to introduce the game. But I actually have a three-part formula here, okay, which is pretty simple, which is, and I say this to parents and teachers, okay, so the first part is check yourself, then check your kid, then check the game. That, you know, so when if you're somebody that tends to have a certain way of seeing things in the world, or if you're a parent that likes really strong limits and is very authoritative, then that's who you are. And then check your kid. Is your kid that sort of kid that's going to respond really well to those sorts of limits? And is your kid someone that does well with interruptions and is flexible, or are they somebody that gets easily frustrated? And then last but not least, check the game, because I think parents do it in reverse. They think about the games and then they think about their kid and then they think about themselves. And it's the opposite.
And I think that's a great point. And I like the fact that you brought up the part in regards to the parents to go ahead and play the game, learn the game, and possibly play the game right with them. I know that I worked with a family some years ago where the 12-year-old was very much into games, but they were the sports related ones. So it was baseball, it was football, but it was all sports. And we had a father who was very, very successful in business and had no knowledge of sports. And so in that particular right situation, what I did was I went and I bought the games for the father, took him to his office and said, you need to take 1 hour a day and learn about the sport and how it's played within this game. Because now mm-hmm it'll be something that you can do with your son, because right now you're telling me that part of your issue is you have nothing in common and you can't bond with your own child. And that became a huge yeah benefit to that. And we actually went from that point on to then teaching the father a little bit about baseball so that he could also then throw the ball with his son and pitch to his son and so on. So mm-hmm I love the fact that you're really focusing on, you know, don't just instantly discard the fact that if it's a game, it's somehow bad for them, but look into it, learn it, and it may be something that you can do together.
You know, that story is just, it highlights, I think, something that so many of us struggle with, which is our education system really teaches us, figure out as soon as you can what your thing is that you're good at and then silo down in it. Okay, so figure out if it's reading, then silo down in it. Figure it out if it's psychology, silo down in it. And then we spend the rest of our lives trying to kind of stay in our zone of kind of excellence or expertise and forget how frustrating all those other subjects were or how school might have been for us in general. And you just reminded me of a young man I used to work with that I hated first-person shooters. That's not my thing. And this guy wanted to play first-person shooters. And he was referred to me for a number of things, including not doing homework, oppositionality with adult requests, a lot of the usual stuff that we see kids and adolescents struggling with. Well, we go to play Call of Duty, and I stunk so badly at Call of Duty. And at first he was mocking me, but then after a little time, he started to be encouraging. And then he basically said to me, you need to practice more. And I knew I had him. And I said, okay, I will agree to an hour a week. I will practice. And I did it for 2 months. I practiced an hour of Call of Duty and my game improved. And then as he was starting to compliment me, I was able to kind of lower the boom. And I said, this is why you need to do homework. It's practice. It's not fun, but it's practice. And guess what? His homework improved because he could see the connection, but more importantly, he could see an adult modeling, yeah, I'm going to do the thing I don't want to do because it will help in its practice.
Yeah, I love that. And in so many situations, any of us that have raised teenagers know that if you immediately tell them you can't do this or you can't have this or you shouldn't do this, you're not really you're not really putting them in the direction you want. In some cases, they're going to do it just because you put your foot down. So I love the way that you did that. We're going to take a break. For everybody out there, we are talking about video games and psychotherapy. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service, licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Our guest is psychotherapist Mike Langlos, and we are talking about video games and psychotherapy.
So, Mike, can you tell us what a creeper is in these games and how they can actually benefit?
I can. So people that play Minecraft will know that creepers are these green, grassy sort of monsters that creep up on you. That's why they're called creepers. And they make a rustling noise as they're getting close if they're behind you. And if you can see them, they start to flash white. And shortly after they flash white, they explode. Oh. And if they explode close enough to you in the game and you're undergeared, don't have a lot of armor, mm-hmm. you basically will die in the game, go back to where you started, and you'll have to run back to the point the creeper got you to get all your loot. Because it's all kind of splattered around where you were.
Right.
And this is actually important. This is important. And I talk about this with parents all the time, and they're listening to me tell this, and they're usually like, why is he telling us about this? And it's because I want to tell them about concentration and attention and anger management. And that, when, for example, if your child is on the computer after school and you are not sure whether they're doing their homework and you want to just go over and say, hey, are you doing your homework? You want to really be mindful about, do you want to do that? Because you're about to become a creeper. What we know about attention is that when people are disrupted from whatever they're attending to, they can lose their attention for about 30 minutes if we're not careful. Mm-hmm. And so that's the equivalent of a creeper sneaking up behind you and blowing up, and all of your thoughts and ideas are now scattered like loot, and it may take you a while to get them again. So it helps parents understand, do I really want to ask that question right now? Am I sure that I need to know what they're doing? Am I sure that I want to interrupt? I've also, since beginning to use this analogy with parents, have heard from parents who also work in corporate environments that they wish someone would talk with their boss about how their boss is a creeper, and that it would be very helpful for the whole work environment if everyone started to really kind of think about, do I really want to sneak up behind somebody and ask them what they're doing? So that's one reason creepers are important. The other reason is they're a good way for you to start teaching kids and youth how to pay attention to their audience, including perhaps parents and teachers and people they have problems with. And just like the creeper flashes white when it's about to blow up, and you have a few seconds to back off, and then the flashing will stop and it won't blow up, people usually have a few signs that they're about to get angry. And how can kids learn how to pay attention to peers and parents to see when those flashes are about to happen so they can back off a little bit?
Okay. And it's funny, I was having a visual while you were telling the story about the creeper, and I can envision some of these kids carrying around like a remote control or something and turning to the person that comes up behind them and pointing it at them and pressing a button and have them go, "What are you doing?" And going, "You're a creeper, I'm making you blow up so that you'll go away." And we have a question that that has been emailed in. And again, I want to thank everybody that takes the time. I know for many people out there that are working, especially a lot of our teachers, they send in some of the questions the night before because they want it asked, and then they're going to listen later on iTunes or Stitcher or however they listen for the answer. So again, thank you for taking the time to send these in and keep them coming. This one reads, "It is alarming to see parents sitting in restaurants with their children, some that could not be older than first grade, all with their heads buried in a cell phone or an electronic device of some kind. I know your use of gaming is therapeutic, but how do you feel about the obvious damage that the loss of this one-on-one connection is having on families? Do any of your techniques encourage conversation? And if so, how is that implemented?" And that's from Frank in Nevada.
Oh, Frank, that's a really good question. And it's a tough one because I tend to think that parents inadvertently model their behavior and model when they're checking their messages or checking emails in the presence of their kids or their family that the kids in the family aren't a priority. So I do think there is an impact there. And I think one of the things I think is really important is to have sort of a democratic model, which is that nobody is checking their messages during dinner, or nobody is checking their messages when we go out, unless for some reason somebody is on call at the hospital, that we have sort of a shared consensus about what the family thinks needs to be important. I also think that quality time is more important than quantity time. So that, for example, you know, I know we have an ideal version of dinner at home where everyone is together and they're meeting every night and the kids are talking about what happened in school and parents are talking to the kids. And that never really happens. That is a very rare thing that it doesn't end up with a fight or someone wishes they were somewhere else. And so what I tend to do is encourage families to kind of only do some nights being family dinner night. And maybe other nights are hot pocket night where everyone gets to have a night where they're kind of either, you know, talking with friends or doing something with playing a game or something. And that the other nights they can actually appreciate each other's company. I think that we try to make a real standardized every night is the right night to do quality time. When the reality is, you know, if only one person in the family had a bad day at school or work, then we're all in trouble. And again, I guess I'd go back to the three-part step thing I told you, which is, you know, check yourself, check your kid, check the technology. So if I just came home from work and nobody was listening to me and I felt like nobody did what I thought they should do, I'm already primed to be grumpy. If my kid is somebody that just got out of study hall and hasn't had a chance to connect with any of their friends yet, and they're home and they're wanting to know what happened at school, that's the second step. And then the third step is the smartphone, because I think if we start with the smartphone, we project all over it. We never know exactly what someone's doing. All we know is they're staring at a piece of glass that's got light going on. You know, I once had a kid that was in my office, and I let kids text with me. And this kid was texting, and he looks up at me. And he goes, "What are you texting about? Who are you texting to?" And he said, "I'm texting this girl in my class that I like. She said she's having a bad day. I don't know what to say about that." And I looked at him and I said, "Well, what do you want someone to say, when you've had a bad day. And he looked at me for a minute, he thought, and then he looked down at the phone and started typing, sorry, you're having a bad day. And that's a moment where someone's actually having a relationship with somebody else. I'm not the person that's the most important person in that moment or that most important relationship. And I think that's one parents have a hard time with, especially as kids get a little older, that they're not the person that their kid wants to be having dinner with every night. It may be a young girl or a young boy in class that they're interested in. And we just have to all grow together, I think, with that.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And I would tend to agree that if you make the family dinner nights a little more special, you know, two or three nights a week or something like that, then it is a little more special, and they'll look at it that way. And then they can take the time to, you know, do the other things, although we're not doing a advertisement for Hot Pockets, but we can certainly certainly decide that we're going to have dinner, you know, in front of the TV or out at a restaurant or something like that. I still think that when you're in the presence of somebody, that if it's at all possible, and as you said, if it's an emergency, if your job calls for that, but I think we're also sending a bad message if we keep, you know, getting a text and then, you know, stopping with whomever it is that we are, and we're dealing with that. It's as if we're saying that other person is more important than them in front of us. And I think we have to model that as parents, that we're not going to take this while our child is telling us about how their day is and go, oh, wait a minute, you know, Cousin Betty is texting me about, you know, plans for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So I agree with you. We are modeling it. And then we should then explain to them why and get them to show the same type of respect when their friend wants to talk about, you know, the volleyball game tomorrow. And we realize that doesn't have to interrupt what it is we're talking about right now.
Right. And can I just add one thing to that? That
sure.
I'm still learning about, I'm still learning my biases here. And one of the biases I have with young adults and adolescents is I often tend to assume they're more technologically savvy than I am. And I think a lot of parents do this. Parents seem to think that, oh, these kids are so quick on all this technology. They just took to it. And they, you know, they're better at it than me. And the other day I was in the office working with a young adult who is in his early 20s. And he was talking about how hard it was. He was setting boundaries with someone who was texting him. And I said to him, well, do you use the do not disturb feature? And he said, the what? And I spent, you know, 2 minutes showing him how both Android and iPhones have a variation of a do not disturb feature, which actually will signal to people that you can't disturb them. A lot of kids and young adults don't even know that feature exists. So the psychology part is really important. But sometimes I think technology, that's why I think therapists need to know and parents need to know how to use the technology, because sometimes kids would be happy to have a do not disturb sign on their text messages so that they don't get disturbed, but they don't even know it exists.
Now, I know that you have workshops that you do, and in your workshops you talk about parents and therapists having a over-the-shoulder perspective. What is that, and how can we move beyond that?
Oh, so this is a good question for me for a radio podcast, because I rely so heavily on videos. But challenge accepted. I will do this. So if you can imagine your kid is playing a game like Portal, or a game like Call of Duty, or any game your kids are playing, what you're probably imagining is, if you're a parent, is standing next to them, looking at the screen for a second, not sure what's going on, but looking at the kid. The kid seems really engrossed in whatever is going on. Kid's not paying attention to you. That's the over-shoulder perspective. It's the perspective where the parent feels ignored and confused, maybe even a little vulnerable or powerless because they can't get the kid's attention. Meanwhile, the kid is not having the sort of counterpart to that. The kid is not feeling empowered over the parent or derisive of the parent. The kid is not feeling, you know, that he's ignoring the parent deliberately or she's ignoring the parent deliberately. The kid is actually involved in
you know, blowing a warp portal into a wall, or, you know, running around in a minefield or something like that. They're in a totally different perspective. And so the parent can start to experience this as the kid being spiteful, or attribute all sorts of motives, or attribute that the kid has an addiction or is, you know, about to become violent and, you know, shoot up a mall or something. And the point is, it's a difference in perspective. And it's also a difference in the emotions that get stirred up. And so that if you can slow this down with parents and kids, what you'll sometimes find is that what kids actually experience in that moment where the parent said, hey, is they're confused. They get sort of snapped out of what they were doing. They're confused. And suddenly they have a parent that's, you know, upset with them, feeling ignored, feeling powerless, feeling frustrated. And they were just playing Portal. They don't know what's going on.
Well, we have another listener question that has come in. This one reads, I am a volunteer coordinator at an inner city YMCA after school program. Many of our youth fall into the at-risk youth category. I read an article on your site about the use of video games as tools for communication and behavior modification. Can you speak to how organizations like ours could possibly use video or online games to plant positive seeds with our kids? And this is from Jody in California. And we have about 2 minutes.
Okay, go. Jody, challenge accepted. So it depends on what you've got at the YMCA. I mean, if you have like a computer center or a resource center where kids are already learning computer skills, you can have a Minecraft class or a coding class. My friend and colleague Mimi Ito does Connected Camps out in California, and I think you would find her stuff really useful. If you want to do stuff in terms of an after-school program where it's more physical education, that's really easy. You can do things like have a creeper be the one that's got a hula hoop that they're holding, and if anyone gets too close to the hula hoop, the creeper starts to make noises. And kids start to learn about boundaries and personal space that way. I would have so many different answers based on what your resources are, but also the age level of kids. I think it also depends on what kids kids are interested in. But the most important thing I would say is inner city youth, YMCAs, and are probably one of the only places that kids can often feel structured and safe and not under threat. That kids in inner city areas often experience going home and playing video games because, you know, there aren't necessarily adequate parks and there aren't necessarily adequate lights or protection. So I'm glad that you're thinking about this. And I think the work you're doing is so important in giving kids a safe place to play.
Well, and Mike, I think the work that you're doing is great as well. Now, for everybody out there, the book is called Reset, Video Games and Psychotherapy. And I'm going to give the website. It's www.gamertherapist.com, or you can go to Mike Langlois, and that's LANGLOIS.com. You can go to either one of those to get more information. Or you can also, for those of you that are driving, don't try to write anything down. Go to our site at answersforthefamily.com. We will have all of Mike's information there. Mike, thank you so much for everything that you're doing. And I really think that more parents, if they would look at it the way in which you're explaining, would probably feel a lot more comfortable about the games that their kids are playing.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right. And for everybody out there, please be sure and put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday when we are joined by Jason Sackett, founder of Managing Upset. And he will be here to discuss how to disarm anger effectively. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com or subscribe to our show through iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, Vimeo, or however you listen. If you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will help us to reach more people and be greatly appreciated. The next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page, check out some of our latest posts, and if you like them, please like us and spread the word. So again, everybody, thank you for listening. Be good human beings, and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.